minutes when I had mine long a couple of weeks ago.
He's got to be quite handy.
Yeah. That could have got it.
That's right.
That's about 60 have more hair than him. All right. Good morning for the last time. We're on the last hour. We always save the best for last. Before we get to Ryan, everyone should find a yellow sheet. Does anyone not have a yellow sheet in front of them? If you don't, it's important. This is your certification that you attended your 12 hours, mandatory 12 hours of judicial education. Fill this out, sign it. Where are we going to turn them in, Mark? Oh, yeah. Your bubble sheets, speaker evaluation sheets, turn them all in together. There'll either be a box at the back or at the registration table one, but this is important. This verifies that you were here. So put your hands together for Ryan Turner.
All right. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Or is it afternoon yet? No, it's still morning. Good morning. Yeah, some of you, I guess I'm like you. How many of you are already thinking ahead for what happens beyond this hour? How many of you are, hey, listen, I already talked to one judge. How many of you are on the 3:30 flight to Dallas? Raise your hand. All right, I'll see you at the airport. I'll be the guy who's working on his laptop probably before we go, because Mark and Kathy and I are, and Katie back at the office, we are wheeling and dealing on bill summary. So we are trying to get these bill summaries done. I hope to see, how many of you are already registered for Legislative Update? You registered? Hope to see all of you at Legislative Update. It's not that far from here to Lubbock. Actually, I think from here to a lot of places it's a long ways. But I still hope to see you in Lubbock or some other Legislative Update. All right. I had a good visit last night with one of the municipal judges, and she asked me to do something, and I think it's a good idea. So I'm going to, very quickly, before we get started, if you are a current board member or a past board member for the Texas Municipal Courts Association, would you make your presence known by standing up just for one moment? Someone can give you an acknowledgement and a round of applause. Where are you, TMCA people? All right. Wait. Someone is cheating. Excuse me, ma'am. Now you're going to stand up by yourself. Are you not involved? You're on TMCA. Okay, let's do this. If you're involved in a TMCA, or if you're TMCA's legislative committee, also make your presence known. That would be you, Judge. Thank you very much. All right, thank you very much. All right, TMCA did a real bang-up job this year in the Texas legislature, and I hope y'all are all aware of the fact that, you know, something that people thought might not ever happen has come to pass. That marriage bill has been signed by the governor. So you will all have the authority to conduct marriage ceremonies September 1st. May God have mercy on your souls. All right. Hey, I already talked to one judge, says she's also a divorce lawyer. She's afraid she might get business on the front end and on the back end. With that said, let me tell y'all what we're about to do. We are going to be talking, and this is kind of, I guess this is a shout out for some of you folks who have been doing this for a while. How many of you have been municipal judges for, let's say, 15 years or more? Where are you? Okay. You know, we do the best we can at these schools. You know, this is kind of, when you come to a regional school, you know, this is the potpourri approach. This is the mosaic approach to judicial education. You know, a little of this, a little of that, something new, something borrowed. It sounds like a wedding. We try to mix this thing up. And one of the things that I got last year from a judge is she said, you know, look, I appreciate this, but I've been doing this a long time, and I practice criminal law, and every now and then I want something advanced, all right? And, of course, you say that, and then other people are saying, oh, my goodness, what is he saying? Does this mean that you're about to confuse me for the next hour and 15 minutes? And my answer is, no, I'm not, but I am going to tell you that what we're about to talk about, we've never spoken about. That this presentation has not been made at a judge's conference by TMCEC. And we're going to be, you know, we especially after legislative session, we spend so much time talking about procedural changes and new process and things like this. We've decided to revisit a very fundamental issue that I personally believe is more complicated than people make it out to be, which is culpable mental states. And so let's go ahead and I want to just kind of get the ball rolling by talking to you today about where we're going with this. You know, when I say culpable mental states, we're now talking not about process. This is not procedural law whatsoever. This is substantive law. We're talking about the building blocks, the very fundamental elements of a crime. And I got to tell you where this thing comes from. It comes from this assumption, which is wrong, that everything in municipal court, or almost everything, is strict liability. Okay? That the state has no responsibility at trial to prove some level of fault. Okay? Either that someone did something intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly. And when I started looking into this, I found out this thing is a lot more complicated than I even knew it was. And there are a lot of interesting nuances. And so, yes, probably, truth be known, I might be making your prosecutor's jobs a little harder at trial after you get through listening to me for the next hour and 15 minutes. The good news is that if your prosecutors have come to school this year, they've already heard this presentation, and they know exactly what I'm about to tell you. So I want to make sure everyone's on the same page. All right, so our theme is criminal responsibility. We're going to talk about what is a crime, and I start off with this paper, and I'm using kind of a hybrid of interactive notes. I like, when I use interactive notes, I like to have a lot of text, so it's almost like reading a paper where you've got the annotations, where you don't have to go look for these things. I want to give you everything you need. Let me explain to you the format of this. When we start seeing things that are bold, that have bold print, bold means I'm pulling this right out of the penal code or the code of criminal procedure. You don't have to have a code book with you. I'm giving you the law, and we're literally going to walk through some black letter law today and take a look at how it applies to certain issues. The other thing that I have done is, you know, I start off, I'm just curious, do I have any people, anyone go to St. Mary's Law School? I have any St. Mary's folks in here? All right. Well, then, here's a little shout out to one of your very own. Here's a passage from Professor Ramey. I begin with a passage from Professor Ramey who talks about what is criminal responsibility. So if you want to kind of get a good grasp on this, take a look, you know, when we get done with this passage from Professor Ramey. And the other thing is, you know, as an adult educator, you're always encouraged to try to mix it up. I mean, you're supposed to, like, appeal to different learning styles. You're supposed to ask a question every 2 or 3 minutes. You're supposed to challenge the audience to re-engage, to bring them back to the point. And if y'all haven't noticed, because, you know, I'm sure, how many of y'all go to conferences other than ours? I mean, you have to go to other conferences. And you always notice a couple of recurring themes, right? Like, one of them I like to call is a death by PowerPoint, where, like, everyone just bludgeons you with these things. I mean, there's, like, PowerPoints for everything. And then, of course, you've always got the PowerPoint Ranger, you know, that person who thinks that if they can have enough gizmos and gadgets in the PowerPoint, that somehow is going to boost their speaker evaluation. Man, and then the other thing is, I always like it when you can find clever pictures or good cartoons. Man, oh man, sometimes it's tough. Trying to find a cartoon on culpable mental states, not so easy. And this is the funny thing. So I'm doing this big Google search trying to find some clip art, and I end up finding this diagram that I've put on page 1 of your paper. I want you to check this thing out. This is out of a law review from Trinity College. This is like from Ireland. And this is taken from an article called The Treatment of the Voluntarily Intoxicated Offender in England. Okay? And this is literally a diagram that appeared in this law review that tried to draw a picture, to give you a schematic of what a crime looks like and what a person has to have for a crime to be a completed offense. And so I thought that was a good thing to throw on out there, to just to kind of give you some, for those of you who like diagrams. I don't know, are any of y'all into mind mapping? Have any of y'all ever studied mind mapping, of like how you can take an idea and draw it out into circles? So this kind of appeals to people who like that. Formulation of a crime. Okay, I like the joke, and it's not true, because, you know, jokes have to have some basis of truth or they're not funny. Okay, but I also like to joke a lot that, you know, the reason why a lot of us went to law school is because we weren't that good at math, and those of us that are good at math are only good at figuring out contingency fees, 33 and a third, 40% contingency fees. That's aimed at you, Glenn Phillips, by the way. So this whole idea of a contingency, we look at formulas, we think formulas are for those people who were good at math, science, and engineering. But, you know, we do use formulas even in undergraduate education. We're teaching college students at St. Edward's University, where I teach. This is a formula that every freshman undergraduate criminal justice student is introduced to. So I'm curious, how many of you have seen this before? How many of you are personally familiar with this equation? Mens rea plus actus reus equals crime. This is the mathematical formulation of a criminal offense. And if you don't have this formula, you don't have a criminal offense. Now, there are some exceptions we're going to talk about. But generally speaking, unless you've got this, you don't have a crime. And my joke, of course, is that I think the reason why behavioral and social science people like using these things is because this is one of the few opportunities we have to do anything that looks like math. Because otherwise, we don't want to talk about math. All right. Well, this is the formulation of a crime. And so if someone can prove in a prosecution that someone did it, but that they didn't have the proper culpable mental state, the mens rea. Let me just stop for a second. Mens rea is what they require to be the evil mind, okay, or the mental state that's necessary. The actus reus is the prohibited act or the required act. We're going to talk on this more, but you always have in the formulation of a crime two halves. You've got this. You have this mental component, and you also have this physical component. And the physical component might mean that you did something, or maybe that you didn't do something that you were required to do. More on that in just a minute. Well, that is the formulation that college students see all over the United States every year when they go to college. However, this is what we're talking about this hour. You know, we're not going to be talking about anything but, really, MR. We're going to be talking about mens rea. That's going to be where our focus is. Now, for us to get there successfully, we have to be able to kind of delineate it from some other things. So what's this presentation going to be about? Well, obviously it's going to be about culpable mental states, but we're also going to talk about the role that these culpable mental states play in the formulation of a crime, and we're also going to talk about some issues that relate to alleging and proving culpable mental states. Because when you are sitting as a trial court judge, that's exactly what you're supposed to be looking for. Has the prosecution proven these elements beyond a reasonable doubt? All right, so let's go ahead and jump on in. There are a couple of issues that relate to culpability in Texas law that we have to talk about just on our way to our destination because they're related issues, but they're not exactly the issue we're here to talk about. So I want to go ahead and talk about capacity, sanity, and competency. These are kind of like, you know, these are all the siblings in the family, but we're really only here to focus on this first one. But I want to make sure that you can tell these other three from this big boy here. All right, first of all, capacity. Okay, capacity. This is a great illustration of what we're talking about here. You know, we have this common law doctrine of infancy that we brought to the United States of America that is part of our, that's always been part of our common law, and it's become part of most states' laws in different forms. Here's what the common law defense of infancy was. Simply that because a person is a child, they are physically incapable of having mens rea. They can't have it because the same reason, you know, I'll give you another thing by analogy. Same reason why we have the offense of statutory rape. It's assumed that certain people of a certain age do not have the capacity to consent in sexual intercourse. That's the whole theory. And so that's where we get this common law defense. And Texas absolutely embraces this. It's found in Section 8.07 of the Texas Penal Code. It's called age-affecting criminal responsibility. And it's actually pretty, it's kind of, you know, every state is different. And the way that Texas has decided to do this is actually, for people who don't live in Texas, they actually think it's confusing and bizarre. Because let me tell you in a nutshell what our law is in the state of Texas. Okay, a child is someone who is at least age 10 and no older than 17. If you're 17, you're an adult. Okay, what if you're under 10? Okay, what does that make you? I mean, I don't have the heart to tell my wife, Stephanie, that our son, Liam, is not a child. I mean, sometimes she thinks he's a monster, but I think most of us would agree that even when he's acting bad, he's just acting childish, right? This reminds me of a story. I was given a presentation for the District and County Attorneys Association. I think I was in Corpus Christi, and I was waiting to make my presentation, and there was a fellow from the Attorney General's office who was making a presentation. His entire presentation was on Section 8.07. He was there to talk about age-affecting criminal responsibility. And one of the things that he stated is, you know, first of all, he explains the rule. The general rule in Texas is that children cannot commit criminal offenses. They can't, okay? That is the general rule. A person who is between the ages, you know, that if, you know, if you're under 10, you're not even on the radar. Okay? I don't know what you are. You're like a neophyte or a little one. I don't know what we would call them. A wee one? And that we don't prosecute people who commit crimes who are between the ages of 10 and 17. Now, I know as municipal judges, especially if you haven't studied this very closely, you're saying, that does not jive with my understanding of the criminal court system in the state of Texas. Well, stay tuned. We're going to talk about this in a little more detail. And once again, why is this? Because Texas even believes that these individuals are not, they don't have the capacity to intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly do anything. And y'all have seen some of this in the headlines. How many of y'all remember that y'all heard about the case about the young boy, I think he was 10 or 11, who shot his father with a .22 rifle? Do y'all remember hearing about this like in the last 9 months? That was kind of a pretty high-profile issue. You know, under Texas law, there would be no criminal responsibility whatsoever for that 11-year-old who had murdered his father. Okay, no criminal responsibility. Now, this is where it gets a little confusing. If you're between the ages of 10 and 16, that does not mean we have this alternate universe that we talked about briefly the other day called our juvenile justice system, where we can't send you to civil court and either find that you engaged in delinquent conduct or child in need of supervision. But here's what I got to stress. That's not criminal law. That is absolutely not criminal law. There's no fines imposed. There's no jail imposed. There's no prison imposed. There's no death penalty imposed. Those are the four hallmarks of the criminal justice system or the use of those punishments. They don't use those in the juvenile justice system. So anyway, this presenter is talking, and they have this policy at TDCAA where if you're like a district judge or a county judge, you know, they'll let you come for free. Man, they might want to rethink this policy, because they had this guy. He is in the back of the room, and this guy's giving this presentation. He said essentially what I just said to you. And this district judge raises his hand. He goes, wait a minute. I want to make sure I understand what you're saying. You're trying to tell me that if my granddaughter were walking down an alley and some guy jumped out there and hit her in the head with a brick, that if he was 11 years old, there's nothing we could do with him in our criminal courts. And then the guy says, that's what I'm saying, Judge. That's exactly what I'm saying. And so, you know, a guy reformulates, and y'all have seen this before. You go to conference, you always have a gunner out there in the room, someone who sometimes, you know, just angling to try to get the guy at the front of the room. And, hey, by the way, refrain from that for the next hour if you can. Anyway, he's trying to go again, and he's like three sentences in, and here comes the arm again. He goes, wait a minute. I'm trying to understand something. You're trying to say that if some guy jumps out and hits my granddaughter in the head with a brick and then sexually assaults her, there is absolutely nothing our criminal court system is going to do. And once again, he says, you know, what are we talking about? 11, 12-year-old here? He goes, oh, he's 12. He's 12. The judge is obviously mad at this point. He goes, well, yes, sir, that is what I'm telling you. Okay? So once again, at this point, the room is pretty much annoyed with the conduct of this one participant. Guy is three sentences in there, and then finally, before he even gets going, judge goes, wait a minute. You're trying to tell me this guy can jump out of an alley, hit my granddaughter in the head with a brick, sexually assault her, set my house on fire, kill me and my entire family, and there's nothing that they can do with him in the criminal justice system. And then the speaker at this point has lost his mojo, if you know what I'm saying. It's like he's been demoralized by getting pounded by this howitzer of questions coming from this one judge, and he goes, well, yeah. And then he gets going one more time, and here comes the arm. But as this arm goes up, at the exact same time, about three tables down, another arm goes up, and it's another district judge who's in the room. And instead of calling on the first judge, he goes, yes, sir. And the other judge goes, hey, Bill, shut up. All right. So that is this whole idea of age affecting criminal responsibility. We acknowledge this in Chapter 45 of the Code of Criminal Procedure. I hope y'all never see school attendance cases filed against some kid who is 6 years old, who's going to Head Start or pre-K or something like that, because guess what? Even our school attendance laws, hey, until they're 10, you cannot, they don't, you know, this is an impossibility issue. They're not even a child until they're 10. Okay, why? That explains why we have another law called parent contributing to non-attendance, because if I, as your prosecutor, want to do something about it, I shouldn't be hammering some kid who, you know, is big into Transformers and, you know, doesn't, you know, still, you know, wets the bed every now and then. I should be going after mom and dad and holding them accountable. Okay, so that is capacity. All right, now, here's the next sibling. Here's the next sibling in this age group. All right, competency. Now, competency, you know, this is what I learned while preparing this presentation that I did not know, and I bet you, let me ask you something. How many, first of all, let me define competency. Competency has to do with the ability of an individual to have a meaningful communication and exchange with their defense lawyer. Okay? That's what it means. And if a person is deemed incompetent, then under the Sixth Amendment, they should not be allowed to proceed forth to trial, because how in the world, if they are operating under some, you know, mental defect or some condition, how are they supposed to be able to have, you know, help in the preparation of their own defense? That's the whole theory here. Okay. How many of you, let's see a show of hands again. How many folks do I have in here are either former prosecutors, criminal prosecutors, or also criminal defense lawyers right now? Okay. How many of you have experiences with clients that you think raised issues of competency? You've seen it before. Okay. Now let me just ask you this. How many of you as municipal judges have had people in your courtroom that you had a reason to believe and do believe were operating under some psychological, psychiatric condition that made you wonder, whoa, what are we even doing here? Okay, I know I'm going to ask you for a plea, but you're sitting here talking about the Mars people and the space dust, and you're wearing your aluminum hat and all this other stuff. Okay, well, here's the thing that I learned I did not know. We have a statute in Texas that governs competency. And 46B002 specifically says that all the standards in 46B apply to criminal cases unless it's a misdemeanor that's not punishable by confinement. In other words, our statute in Texas does not contemplate fine-only misdemeanors. Our competency laws do not contemplate fine-only misdemeanors. Now, that's okay, because I got to tell you, I've been working for y'all for 10 years now, and I am watching an evolution in what we're doing. I am seeing an evolution in municipal and justice courts in this state and what's happening. And that's all right. Things will catch up sooner or later. But here is the thing that's a little scary for me. If you were just to think this is the only law on the subject, and if someone came to your court, and we had this happen in the Austin Municipal Court not too long ago. I got this phone call where this guy, he had like a court-appointed guardian, okay? So he's under a guardianship order. He apparently has a lot of psychiatric problems. He has committed all these Class C misdemeanors, and his guardian shows up and asks the municipal court in Austin to appoint counsel because this guy is seriously distressed and has no ability to really understand what's going on. And then they got in all this issue about competency and what do we do, and you know, and it really became a complicated issue. Well, to say, 46B002 says it doesn't apply to fine-only misdemeanors, so I guess you're out of luck, ignores two very important things. One, the Constitution of the state of Texas, and more importantly in my mind, the Constitution of the United States of America. Because the Supreme Court has already stated it doesn't matter if we had 46B002. The Supreme Court has already talked about competency in criminal proceedings. So, judges, please, 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 don't think just because it's not contemplated in our Code of Criminal Procedure. I mean, with all due respect now, I mean, we're done with session, right? How many of y'all know at least one person who's been elected to the Texas House of Representatives? Okay, enough said. I'm just moving on. I'm saying sometimes things get by them. Sometimes they don't get everything right. Sometimes it's not top shelf legislation. Just wait. You come see me at Legislative Update. We'll talk about top shelf legislation. Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. I'm not sure if y'all have even heard about this. Apparently, we were told no new court costs, which I'm sure y'all are glad to hear, no new court costs. And so they threw in all these 10-cent, 15-cent costs, and then someone slipped in. They're like they're playing cards or something, like they threw a card under the door. $60 court cost on all public intoxication offenses that's going to be used to fund drug courts. So, wow. All right. So we understand that competency is not statutorily contemplated in our courts, but we still understand that there are laws that go beyond the code book. Okay. Now, here's the last amigo. Sanity, or the lack therefore of, also known as insanity. Okay. It is something that can be argued in your court. How it's going to be argued by a pro se defendant is above me and beyond me, okay? But you do need to know that it is completely contemplated. Now, what does insanity consist of? Insanity is saying, oh yes, the AR is there, the actus reus. Remember we talked about this, the evil act. Oh yes, he took the bread. Oh yes, he engaged in disorderly conduct. But guess what? He didn't intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly do it. He couldn't because he's mentally distressed. He's operating under a condition that basically eliminates his ability to formulate. Now, I want to make sure we're all clear on this. Back to our mathematical formula. If the state can't prove MR and AR, there is no crime. Half of the formulation is not a crime. You got to prove both parts. All right. Now, and I know what you're saying, but wait a minute. What about strict liability and speeding? Hold on. I'm getting there. This is the big setup. This is the big setup. Now, these fellas over here flank so far right, you might not be able to read this cartoon, so I'm going to read it to you. This is, I got this judge up here who, he kind of looks like Ahab, and he also kind of looks like Colonel Sanders, and he's got this goofy tie on here. No offense if any of you guys like ties like that. Don't take that personally. But anyway, he's up here, and the lawyer who's got like, I don't know, he's kind of got like this Zorro-type cape on himself. He looks like he hasn't had much rest. He's looking a little tired. He needs a new barber. I want to point that out. He's kind of got the bowl cut, and he is pulling one of those classic lawyer moves that any of you who are lawyers who have ever argued in a court of law, sooner or later, you know you're guilty of this, where you've done your aha moment, like your closing moment, like where this is where you reach the apex of your persuasive powers. And I know my favorite standard move is to use my glasses when I'm talking to a jury and saying, ladies and gentlemen, this is the reason why we know it. You know, it's one of these, aha. Well, he's engaged in this thing, and this is what he's saying. He is saying, as you can see, he believes himself to be Breno of the planet Marana, the noblest being of all time. And so the judge is going, what in the name of? And so he concludes with his lawyer power, his persuasive apex moment. He goes, so obviously, my client is not responsible for his actions. And he's got his moment there. Okay. Now, that's it. That's the persuasive argument. There is no MR because he's insane. He's touched. Okay? Something's going on. It cannot be formulated. That is sanity, insanity. Those are the three cousins. Now, we've talked about the three cousins. We can't ignore the AR component. We can't ignore actus reus altogether. Really, we got to talk about it. And so take a look. I'm now, in terms of my interactive notes here, we're getting ready to talk about, we're on page 2 here, and we're looking at Texas Penal Code, Title II, we've talked about culpability, and I'm looking at 6.01, the requirement of a voluntary act or omission. A person commits an offense only if he voluntarily engages in conduct, including an act, an omission, or a possession. Let's make sure we're clear about what these mean, okay? When we're talking about a commission, we're stating that, yeah, she did it, but wasn't allowed to. That's commission, okay? Then the next one is omission. She was supposed to do it, but she didn't do it. And then the final thing is possession. She had it, but she wasn't supposed to have it. Okay, now, every single criminal offense that's prosecuted in district court, county court, justice court, municipal court, it does not matter. When it gets down to actus reus, it has to be COP, either commission, omission, or position, every single time. And as a judge, you need to ask yourself before every jury trial and every bench trial, okay, we're having this offense tried today. Is this an offense that requires the state to prove commission, omission, or possession? COP, COP, easy to remember. You need to be able to think this out. Now, these things, you know, we're familiar with all these in different senses. I want to break these down a little bit further. Now that we understand that you have to have COP to have an actus reus. You have to have commission, omission, or possession. Y'all can think about these quickly already. You already know in municipal court. What's the most common possession thing that we have to adjudicate in our courts? Absolutely. He wouldn't mind, Judge. I wouldn't mind. All right. Yeah, okay. You know, when we think about we got commission and omission. Well, let's make sure, let's talk about this possession thing for a second. What is possession like? Picture's worth 1,000 words. What game is this? That's hot potato, okay? You know, possession is akin to hot potato. And if you even take a look at 6.01b, okay? Possession is a I'm on page 3 now. Possession is a voluntary act that the possessor knowingly obtains or receives the thing possessed or is aware of his control of the thing for a sufficient time to permit him to terminate his control. Well, yeah, that's hot potato now, isn't it? Okay? You know, if you had it and you knew what it was and you had it long enough to know what it was and you continued to have it, okay? Let's think about this. What was the name of the Dallas Cowboy who got in trouble with the authorities and was prosecuted? Oh, which one? We want to go back to, you want to use the 1960s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, or the last 5 years, right? Okay, no. I'll take you back to one. Today, we're not going to talk about Harvey Martin. Talk about Harvey Martin. Now, let's go ahead and talk about Michael Irvin, okay? Not the first time Michael Irvin got in trouble and had to hire Royce West and they had the big trial there in Dallas County. No, no, let's talk about the second time that the playmaker ran the wrong route, okay, and got in big trouble. Do y'all remember? What happened the second time? Anybody remember this? Because I don't think this got much attention, but I was paying attention. And I, by the way, I'm a huge Michael Irvin fan, too. That might be the reason I was paying attention. He was about to get into the Hall of Fame. He was about to get into the Hall of Fame. And do you remember? It stopped him for 2 years before he was able to get in. Drug paraphernalia, okay? And here's what his story was, that he had a friend who came to his house who had this stuff, and he said to his friend, man, you can't have that stuff around my kids. Let me have that. And then he took it, and he put it in his car underneath the seat, okay? Okay, let's go back to this. Then obviously, subsequently, he gets stopped, and they find the drug paraphernalia in the car. Where should the playmaker have put that stuff? In the garbage, in a landfill, anywhere but in your car, because then it goes back to care, custody, and control and all those affirmative links that we use even in drug cases. So that's possession. 6.01c, a person who omits to perform an act. Now we're talking about omission. Okay, we've already talked about possession. We've talked about commission. Here is the omission. Okay, a person who omits to perform an act does not commit an offense unless a law, and I underlined law in your paper here, as defined by section 1.07 provides that the omission is an offense or otherwise provides that he has a duty to perform the act. Okay, well, what are we talking about? When they say law, what in the world does that all include? Well, let me tell you. Law is going to include the Constitution or a statute. It's going to include a written opinion of a court of record, which is stunning to me because I've never heard of this before, but it's the law. According to the law, a written opinion of a court of record is a law. Wow. And don't tell Rush Limbaugh, man. That sounds like activist judges if they're making law from the bench, but that's just the way the Texas statutes have been written. It also includes a municipal ordinance. Now, this is where your ears should start perking up on this, okay? Also, it's going to include the order of a commissioner's court. It's also going to include rules authorized and lawfully adopted under a statute. Okay? Omission is, in simplest terms, failure to act. Okay? Let's think about, first of all, not in the universe of municipal and justice court jurisdiction. Let's go outside for a second. Think of the most famous criminal ever to be toppled, not because of the heinous things he did, but because of the thing that he did not, that he failed to do. Who am I thinking of? Al Capone. We couldn't get him on murder. We couldn't get him on anything. We got him on tax evasion. Okay? We got him on tax evasion. Now let's go back to the municipal and justice court universe. All right? Think about some of the most common omission crimes you see in municipal and justice court on a daily basis. Give me some. Hit me. That's a big one. I got to say that nuisance abatement relating to tall weeds, garbage, and vehicles make up a substantial part of municipal ordinance prosecution. Okay? What else? Curfew. That's interesting. Now, is curfew an omission or is it a commission? See how these things can get a little more complicated? I'm not even sure off the top of my head, Judge, what the answer is. Is it that they failed to go home at a proper time? Or is the offense stated in the inverse that you were out when you weren't supposed to be? Do you see how this can get a little more complicated than people might think it is? All right. I heard another one.
Dogs at large.
You failed to restrain your dogs. Okay. That makes me think the curfew might also be a mission. I don't know. I'm still kind of up in the air on that one. All right. So we understand where we're going with. We know that we see these things. We have commission. We have a mission. We have possession. Just like every other criminal court in the United States of America, COP, we got the actus reus component down. That's fine. We got it. Which brings us to why we are here today, ladies and gentlemen. We are here to talk about the requirement of culpability. And I'm going to challenge some of the things that some of you folks who have been doing this longer than I've had my bar card may have come to believe over the years. Because I have to tell you, some of the stuff I used to believe, found out while researching this, I was mistaken. All right. First of all, let's talk about 6.02A of the Penal Code. What does Texas law tell us? 6.02 is very clear. Except as provided in subsection B. I'm on page 3 now. Except as provided in subsection B. A person does not commit an offense unless he intentionally, knowingly, recklessly, or with criminal negligence engages in conduct as the definition of the offense requires. What can we extrapolate from this rule of law? What we can extrapolate from this rule of law is very, very straightforward. If there is no proof of a culpable mental state, no crime has been committed. It's just that simple. Now, there's an exception. It's coming. Stay tuned. But what happens sometimes, especially with a prosecutor who doesn't think that their judge is going to require them to prove it, is they will only focus on AR. They'll focus on the actus reus. Well, he had the loaf of bread in his hands. He had it in his bag. Let me ask y'all something. If any of you ever had anything embarrassing like this happen to you, like when you've got a little kid with you and you're going to the grocery store and little kid grabs something off the rack and pulls something into the basket, do you see how that could easily be construed as theft? Okay? That happened to me, man. My 2-year-old reaches off out of the basket. He grabs this thing of sunflower seeds. He pulls them into the basket. We had like a blanket with him, and it was in the blanket. And I caught the thing as we were checking out, and I threw it. But I was kind of scared for a second because I thought to myself, son, you were only 2. You don't need to be engaging in criminal acts. And then I thought back to the rule of capacity, right? Okay. So what I'm saying is it's not enough to prove that they did it. It's just not enough to prove that they did it. They have to prove one of the requisite mental states. That's where we're going with this. Now, the Court of Criminal Appeals has chimed in on this. This is nothing that has not made it all the way beyond our 14 intermediate appellate courts. This is not something that just the county courts handling appeals from municipal and justice courts have dealt with. This has gone all the way to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. This is a case that's called Honeycutt versus State. All right, tell you a funny story. This is like my, 13th time to make this presentation. Second time I made the presentation, Lester Rorick was in the room. And how many of y'all had Lester Rorick's class yesterday? How many of y'all went to the driving on the right side of the road class? Yeah, found out Lester Rorick was the prosecutor in this case. He was prosecuting this. And this happened in the city of Pasadena. And the city of Pasadena had adopted an ordinance that made it a criminal offense to have a car wreck. Okay, that was the ordinance. Ordinance violation is you had a car wreck. And the culpable mental state that was required was called negligent collision. Okay? In other words, they made up their own culpable mental state. Court of Criminal Appeals invalidated this ordinance because while the government code and while the Texas legislature can give cities the authority to create certain rules, Texas Penal Code does not authorize, nor has the legislature ever authorized, cities to make up their own mental states. Okay? It's not a BYOMS. You've got to use one of the standard M1, A1 state-assigned mental states. You can't make up your own. Now, I got to tell you, that has not always stopped the Texas legislature from slipping and creating offenses that don't use one of the 4 culpable mental states that you've heard me talk about today. Can any of you think of a very common Class C misdemeanor that is adjudicated in your court where the legislature, through some weird circumstance, made up a culpable mental state that is not intentionally, knowingly, reckless, or with criminal negligence? You want a clue? Okay. If it's not failure to appear, what is the other primary non-appearance crime we see? Violate promise to appear. Does anybody recall what the culpable mental state is? Willfully. Willfully. I am still waiting for some criminal defense lawyer to use Honeycutt to take on the Texas legislature in using some make-believe culpable mental state. All right. Okay, so that's the requirement of culpability. Now, 6.02b. 6.02b tells us that... Oh, wait, do I need to point something out here? No, not yet. I'll get to it in just a second. All right, 6.02b, I'm on page 4. If the definition of an offense does not prescribe a culpable mental state, a culpable mental state is nevertheless required unless the definition plainly dispenses with any mental element. Now, this is important. What they're stating here is that just because the definition of an offense does not contain a culpable mental state does not mean that one is not required. Let me repeat that. Just because it's not in the code book when you read the elements of the offense doesn't mean it's not required. To the contrary, it has to say expressly no culpable mental state is required. It has to state that. Okay? And I'm going to give you an example where it does say that. Chapter 49 of the Penal Code, alcohol-related offenses. Is there any culpable mental state for DWI? None. Is there any culpable mental state for public intoxication? None. Is there any culpable mental state for open container? Absolutely none. Why do we know this? Because chapter 49 says so, that there is no culpable mental state required. So in other words, this is an instance where the legislature has complied with 6.02. They didn't want the state to have to prove mental state, so they stated it. How often do they do that? How often do you see something in the transportation code where it says no culpable mental state's required? No culpable mental state's required. In fact, how many of you think you could even find in the transportation code where it says no culpable mental state's required for speeding? Because that's the one you're thinking of right off the bat. If you've been doing this for any period of time, you know that there is no culpable mental state required for the prosecution of speeding. But guess what? I tried to find it, and it's a futile effort. I looked for 2 days. I started going insane. I started calling other lawyer friends of mine. I'm looking and looking and looking. Could never find it. Why could I not find it? Because it's not in there. It was determined by the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals in a case called Zuloff, where the Court of Criminal Appeals declared and decreed through the use of their power that this is an offense that does not require any culpable mental state. So don't go looking for it in the code book. You're never going to find that speeding does not have a culpable mental state. All right, so this is an important statute. And notice, it doesn't say the statute is inapplicable to Class C misdemeanors. This is the rule that applies to every criminal offense in the state of Texas. And this is the funny part. It uses this word required. But required what? I mean, required to be alleged, required to be proved, required to be alleged and proved. I think in a perfect world, we'd all agree it's going to be required to be alleged in the complaint and proven at trial. However, where are my criminal defense lawyers again? Where are y'all? You raised your hands earlier. Don't hide now. Okay? What happens if there is a defect in the charging instrument and the defense fails to object to it? It's waived, okay? That's the reason I stated in a perfect world, it's going to be alleged and proved. But we know we don't live in a perfect world, so we've got all this case law that deals with these imperfections in the universe that we live in. All right, now, this gets us down to this whole idea of the exception. We understand that unless the definition plainly dispenses with any mental element. Okay, That's where we're going with this. That's what this whole presentation is about. Questions so far? All right. Are most criminal offenses strict liability? This is something we need to ask ourselves as municipal judges. Okay? And the answer is no. And the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals has told us as much. In fact, it's where we're supposed to begin. Court of Criminal Appeals told us in a case called Aguirre versus State. How many of you are familiar with this case? Aguirre versus State, 1999, Texas Court of Criminal Appeals began in the El Paso Municipal Court, went all the way through. You know, in El Paso, you start off. Do I have anyone here from El Paso? Do I have any El Paso folks here? Okay. You know, we start off in the municipal court, and then when we appeal it, it doesn't go to county court. It goes to the Municipal Court of Appeals. Okay. It goes to Judge Odell Holmes' court. And then from there, it doesn't go to county court. Oh, no, no. Now it goes to the Intermediate Court of Appeals out in El Paso, one of the 14 state Intermediate Court of Appeals. Okay. So we had a case. I know this case well because I actually worked on one of the drafts of this opinion when I worked at the Court of Criminal Appeals. Teresa Aguirre, still remember her name. Teresa Aguirre was prosecuted under a sexually oriented business ordinance that stated that you could not engage in a sexually oriented business if you were within so many feet of a church or a school or things of this nature. And she was, how do we say it, an adult entertainer. Okay, she was prosecuted, and the whole issue here is, well, wait a minute, the ordinance was silent as to if Teresa had to intentionally, knowingly, recklessly, or with criminal negligence engage in the violation of the ordinance. That was the whole basis of the case. Now, one of the things that made this, the reason why Aguirre is such a significant case is because it gives us a test that you as judges can use on any Class C misdemeanor. When the legislature is silent, Aguirre is going to give you a test, a litmus test that you can apply to any criminal offense to determine if the state should have to prove a culpable mental state. The other reason why Aguirre is a very important case is it is the only time in the history of the Court of Criminal Appeals where members of the court have engaged in an extensive discussion of municipal court prosecution. It's the only published decision. What's the only decision, published or unpublished? And let me tell you why that came up. Okay, there is an agency that some of you may have never heard of, especially if you don't practice criminal law, but it's called the State Prosecuting Attorney's Office. How many of you are familiar with the SPA's office? You have heard of the SPA's office? SPA is essentially the Solicitor General for the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. He also has the authority to go help in intermediate appellate courts. That rarely happens. However, this individual is the primary prosecutor in the Court of Criminal Appeals. And quite often, county and districts, by the time a case gets up to the Court of Criminal Appeals, they are so broke or they don't have enough money, the SPA's office comes in to help them out. In this specific case, and I'm trying to think of the fellow's name and I'm stroking out, the city attorney in El Paso at this period of time, his first name was Herb, and I can't remember his last name. You remember it? Huh? Herb Fleming. Herb Fleming was the city attorney, and his office had prosecuted this ordinance offense, and it went to the Municipal Court of Appeals, and then it went to the Intermediate Court of Appeals, and the Intermediate Court of Appeals reversed the conviction on the basis that the state had not proven culpable mental state and that the ordinance required one because state law said that unless you expressly waive it in your ordinance, you got to prove one, okay? Well, Herb then asked the SPA's office, it was Matthew Paul, asked him to take this case up to the Court of Criminal Appeals, and it really set off a firestorm inside of the Court of Criminal Appeals. Cheryl Johnson had just gotten elected to the Court of Criminal Appeals, and she took the position that the SPA's office had absolutely no right to handle this case because the request had been made by, ready for this, a city attorney. And the statute that created the SPA's office said that the SPA could only help the offices of county attorneys and district attorneys, but said nothing about city attorneys. So before we could get to the culpable mental state issue, we had to have this big debate and have all these opinions from these learned jurists about, well, who can prosecute municipal court in the first place and how does that relate to the state? And this is the reason I want you to know about this case, because how many of y'all have city attorneys in rural Texas? No, hopefully you all have city attorneys. Hold on, don't raise your hands that fast. How many of you have city attorneys that really don't think that they have to prosecute in your court? They act like they don't have any duty to, okay? This is the case where the Court of Criminal Appeals made a couple things clear. County attorneys have a constitutional right to prosecute any misdemeanor, be it in county court, justice court, or even municipal court. How many of y'all knew that? Do any of y'all have your county attorney prosecute in municipal court? There are probably 16 cities in the state of Texas. And you know what my experience has been? Those are good politicians. County attorneys who figure out, you know what? This might help me with my relationship with the city if I send one of my assistants down there to municipal court. They tend to figure that out. Now, how many of y'all have a criminal district attorney where there is no county attorney to speak of? In other words, your criminal DA does everything from traffic tickets to capital murder. His office is doing everything. If y'all have a criminal DA, the criminal DA has all the authorities of the constitutional county attorney. So those people can also prosecute in municipal court. But do they have a duty to? Absolutely not. They have the authority to, they do not have the duty to, and additionally, they can receive no compensation for it. Why? Because they already have the right to do it. That's the reason why they can't double dip and get compensation out of it. Now, I'm not saying cities haven't been known to pay for LexisNexis or provide other benefits for these prosecutors, but they can't pay them directly, cash in hand. All right, now, let's pivot this a bit. How about the city attorney? The city attorney has a duty. It is the only duty imposed upon a city attorney in state law. It's in Article 45.201, and you should go look at it, especially if you have a city attorney whose attitude is that he or she has no obligation to prosecute. The other thing that kind of concerns me, and this has happened in New Braunfels a long time ago, is that it's not a city can have as many city attorneys as it wants. It could have a city attorney for wastewater, a city attorney for utilities, a city attorney for economic development. It's not a constitutional office, so you can have as many city attorneys as you want. But sometimes cities get sloppy with this, and rather than having a city attorney, they have someone they just call the municipal prosecutor. And guess what? There is no such thing as a municipal prosecutor. So I hope you are all aware of the fact that if you have someone prosecuting in your court, they better be a city attorney, a deputy city attorney, okay, an assistant city attorney, or an attorney pro tem. That's the other way they can prosecute in your court. But they have to fall into one of those four categories. All right. Ultimately, the Court of Criminal Appeals found that the SPA had the right to help the SBA because of the fact that the prosecutor is a prosecutor. And as such, that issue was set aside. Okay, now, back to the issue of strict liability, however. Essentially, the position of the defense was that the position of the state was that that there was no culpable mental state required, that it was strict liability. And the position of Teresa Aguirre was, well, guess what? You can't just do that. It has to be expressly stated. So this is what we came up with. You know, some of the things that Aguirre tells us is that the most important factor in more recent cases is the subject of the statute. Strict liability, and by the way, just to want to make sure everyone's clear, when I say strict liability, I want to make sure everyone knows what I mean. Strict liability means the only thing the state has to prove is AR. They only have to prove actus reus. They don't have to prove anything but either commission, omission, or possession, and we're done. Okay, but they still have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. The court pointed out that in the newer cases, strict liability is traditionally associated with the protection of public health, safety, or welfare. Okay? Now, some of you folks who have been doing this for a long time are saying, hey, Ryan, that's everything we do. Okay? And that's a fair thought. Okay? I agree with you. Okay? But it's not that simple. You need to know right now, the state lost this case. Ultimately, there was a culpable mental state that the Court of Criminal Appeals said had to have been proven because it wasn't expressly waived. And as much, don't think just because it falls into one of these little neat categories, because everything, debatably, I mean, isn't that criminal law? Doesn't everything in criminal law fall in one of those categories? Okay. Now, I think this is the slide right here where I did list. Here we go. Yeah, on page 4, y'all heard me talk about Zuloff. Zuloff, I give you the citation for Zuloff on page 4. The offense of speeding is strict liability and requires no showing by the state that the person charged with such offense acted intentionally or knowingly. They cite an older case called Goodwin versus State. If y'all like reading case law, go read Goodwin. It's hilarious. Cars are new. They're like new technology. And people are still trying to figure out what to do with this newfangled technology called the horseless carriage. And they're getting, it's like the same issues we have with the internet. Back in the days of Goodwin, they're still trying, there was no transportation code. There were no uniform traffic laws. And so it's really a good case to read. Goodwin cites a hilarious case. Some legislator got really hacked off that he got a speeding ticket. So he changed the law of Texas to say that you could not give someone a speeding ticket unless, one, the person could see the police officer at the time that they were speeding, and secondly, the person had to be in their police uniform with their badge, and that their clothes had to be ironed and crisp, and their necktie had to be folded. It was ridiculous, all the stuff that the legislature ended up putting into that bill. And every now and then, how many of y'all have seen that argument in your court? None of you? Because we still annually will get one call from a court where some Republic of Texas folk or some sovereign defendant is trying to argue this 1913 Court of Criminal Appeals decision that talked about that stuff. All right, moving on. Now, Aguirre tells us that when the legislature is silent, that we're going to use a test. And I'm going to teach you all the tests so y'all can use it whenever you have to. And they say that the conclusive feature, this is the no-brainer, right? What would be the easiest feature? The easiest feature would be just be, hey, legislature, if you want this to be a strict liability, then say so. We don't have to do any more analysis. If there is an affirmative statement that the offense is strict liability, we are done for the day. That's all we need to do. However, and Judge Womack wrote this opinion, and he's smart, and he is not living in an ivory tower. He goes, you know what? That might be the law, but the legislature could make such a statement, but they rarely, if ever, do so. The typical strict liability statute is empty. It simply says nothing about a mental state. Okay, so what have I just told you in the last 10 minutes? What I've told you is that even if the statute says nothing, they still have to prove a culpable mental state. And I'm also telling you that the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals has also said that a lot of the ones that are strict liability also say nothing. This is for you folks who wanted something more advanced. Okay? Now, they have given us a series of factors. I think these factors are important. I'd like you to know these. You don't have to memorize them, but be able to pull this paper up, okay, and be able to apply this test if it comes up. This is how the argument's going to be. Your Honor, I'm going to make a motion for a directed verdict. The state's failed to prove a culpable mental state. Your Honor, state's not required to prove a culpable mental state. They've waived the defect in the charging instrument. This is what the argument's going to sound like, okay? And you're going to sit there and you're going to go, oh my gosh, I can't believe it. I'm actually trying a criminal offense called cat litter in a cave. I don't know if anyone has ever thought about if there's a culpable mental state for illegal disposal of cat litter in a cave. By the way, that is a real criminal offense in the Parks and Wildlife Code. Okay, so let's talk about the test. The first thing they tell us is take a look at the legislative history. Yes, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals is saying you can look at extra-textual sources when it comes to this stuff. The statute or its title or the context may throw some light on the matter. Keep in mind, the same test we're using now, you can also use it on your city ordinances. I had a judge early in the academic year goes, Ryan, you're living in an ivory tower. And I said, whoa, keep in mind, I work for TMCC. We cannot afford ivory. We're lucky if we have vinyl or linoleum, okay? But he said city councils, there is no legislative history of a city ordinance. Okay, look, now I want to slow down. Time out on the field on this. If you have a city attorney, or if you have anyone who has worked in municipal government, you should have some legislative history on your ordinances, okay? I got to tell you, in Austin, Texas, there is tons. Everything's going to start off in a subcommittee. Everything's going to have a committee report. A committee report's going to be referred back to the city council. City council's going to have it in its minutes. You're going to have debate. How many of you have your cities record city council meetings? How many of them even record and broadcast subcommittees on public access? I got to tell you, if you can't sleep in Austin, just turn on public access and flip it on over to the municipal channel where you can watch them, watch the zoning, the P&Z. Woo, I'm gone. That's it. I can watch P&Z for 5 minutes and I am out. Okay? You can find out, it is possible to find out the legislative intent by listening to tape recordings. For state law, it's really cool. The newer legislation, you can go online and listen to the committees and listen to the debates. The older bills, you can go to Austin and you can go to the legislative library and pull up bills from 1915 and see all these fantastically written documents. I got to tell you something. If you have not figured this out, technology is not great for human beings in the sense that, one, we can't spell anymore. Secondly, we don't know how to do mathematics. And I got to tell you, with the advent of GPS, our grandchildren will not be able to read a map. Okay? And if you want proof on how far we have fallen, go read legislative history from the 1920s at the Texas legislature. It's incredibly well written. Okay? And it doesn't look like the stuff you see online today. It's better. All right. Now, next up, the severity of the punishment. Now, this gets confusing a little bit. The severity of the punishment provided for the criminal offense is of importance. Other things being equal, the greater the possible punishment, the more likely some fault is required. And conversely, the lighter the punishment, the more likely the legislature meant to impose liability without fault. All right. I'm a little critical of this paragraph. Let me tell you why. First of all, the greater and the lighter, what is that? Is that like supposed to mean the greater and the lesser, or the heavier and the lighter, or the funnier or the less funny? I mean, we get in this thing about standards here. Some of you may say, okay, well, this is simple, Mr. Turner. It means that if it's a felony, you got to have a culpable mental state, and if it's a misdemeanor, you don't. And I would suggest to you, Your Honor, with all due respect, read Aguirre. This was a Class C misdemeanor where they said you had to have a culpable mental state. That's not what they meant. It's not that simple. Keep in mind also, I'm going to give you six factors to apply. I'm going to give you six factors to apply, and guess what? They're not, no one of them is, the, only the first one. The conclusive feature is the only one that's conclusive. The rest of them, and this ought to be fun for you folks like, you know, Judge from Kilgore over here who's been on the bench a long time. You're supposed to do a weighing analysis. You've got to weigh these factors out to figure out what the law says. That's exactly right. Flip a coin is what Judge Phillips is saying. All right. Now, so that's the severity of the punishment. That is the severity of the punishment. Questions on any of the first two criteria? Okay. Secondly, is the seriousness of the harm to the public. All right. This is where it gets complicated. The seriousness of the harm to the public, which may be expected to follow from the forbidden conduct, is another factor. Other things being equal, the more serious the consequence to the public, the more likely the legislature meant to impose liability without regard to fault, and vice versa. Okay. So let's pretend you're all not judges, and let's pretend, you know, there's no one else in here. You're all judges, except you got Mark and I, and you know, we're your obedient servants and all this stuff. So let's go ahead and just have a little straight talk. I know the election year is over, but I'm still in the mood for a little straight talk. Okay, let me ask y'all something. Okay, when we use seriousness of the harm to the public, let's talk about for a second marijuana. Seriousness of harm? Is there seriousness of harm? Possession of marijuana? Anyone want to be bold, step out over the line? I just want you to raise your hand. I'm smart on this. I'm asking closed questions. Okay. Okay, let's do this for a second. So possession of marijuana, help me out, criminal defense lawyers. Let's say I got more than 6 ounces. What's that going to score me in terms of penalty range? Anybody know? Not more than a year? Okay. Okay, so I'm looking at what, a Class A misdemeanor? Okay, let's try to use seriousness of harm. You want to see how hard this is to apply? I'm going to tell you a real story. This is a case that I prosecuted in municipal court in the last year. Had a person who owned a restaurant. I will not give you the name of the restaurant, even if you come up afterwards and say, please tell me the name of the restaurant. I'm still not going to tell you the name of the restaurant. You can go find it out. It's public records. But it is a famous restaurant that began in Austin that the mother who started it gave each of her children one of the restaurants. And it was a taco stand. It's a famous taco stand. And what we ended up having happen was this. We had a situation where we all of a sudden had people calling City Hall stating that their family members were becoming deathly ill. They were being hospitalized left and right. We sent out our code enforcement officer, and we found a situation where, and I got photographs of this, where first of all, raw hamburger meat was being mixed with ice. The ice was then subsequently being used for soft drinks. Okay? Now, look, I couldn't get any sound out of this audience at all. For the record here, because we are recording this, I couldn't get any sound out of y'all when I talked about marijuana. But y'all were just disgusted by that. So maybe I'm onto something. Now, secondly, there were holes in the floor where rodents were coming in. There were potatoes on the floor that were being eaten by rodents. There were rodent droppings inside the restaurant. There was also, in the refrigerator, food that was not covered and it was not dated. Okay, I ended up filing about $20,000 worth of complaints against this fellow. All right, now, seriousness of harm. Possession of marijuana versus tainted food. Are we really going to say that you gauge the seriousness of the harm based off of the punishment? Is that really the determinative factor? Because if that's the case, that this is one of the things that I got to tell you in Austin, I'm up against all the time. When I'm trying to talk to people about why municipal courts are important and they go, it's not important because it's a fine, they're missing the point. I think that my case involving this taco stand makes the point. How many of y'all have children? How many of you have elderly parents? I want you to think about what would happen if your elderly parent or your young child ate that food. By the way, did you see I've already practiced my voir dire on this? Okay. That's an excellent case in point. Let me give you one more war story and I'll move on quickly. Do any of y'all use Google Earth? Do y'all know what I'm talking about? Google Earth, where you use satellite views of things? I had a situation using Google Earth where I had a woman who had apparently not maintained her septic system since, I don't know, George H.W. Bush was president. And it was so bad that it was notable by use of Google Earth. We could see a river of dew. Okay, from up in a satellite view coming down, and we ended up having a swath of waste that was 10 feet long, okay, no, not 10 feet, what am I saying? It was 45 yards long and 20 yards wide. And my code enforcement officer went out one morning, got down on his knees, and I swear, this is like Ansel Adams quality court photography, okay, gets a picture of this huge river of poo-poo. And off on the horizon, you can see two little boys playing basketball. Okay? I blew that thing up to a picture about this big and came in because she had hired a lawyer. And I said, hey, how are you doing? I'm Ryan Turner. This is what I got. I held it up. He goes, okay, we're done. And that was the end of the case. All right, now. So the seriousness of the harm, be careful with this. You know, don't fall into the easy, say, oh, yeah, seriousness of harm. I mean, it's not that. Look, y'all are all trying to prevent the greater harm. That doesn't mean there's no harm. Okay. The defendant's opportunity to ascertain the facts. This is another important issue, and this is the one that for me is the hardest to apply. We're still on page 5. The defendant's opportunity to ascertain the true facts is yet another factor which may be important in determining whether the legislature really meant to impose liability on one who was without fault because he lacked knowledge of these facts. Hey, by the way, this is the reason why when I talk to code enforcement officers, always give a warning. It helps prove culpable mental state. Always give a warning. Okay. Also, don't misread this. I had one judge who said, well, isn't this essentially saying ignorance of the law is a defense? That's not really what I think they're trying to say here. They're just saying the defendant's ability to ascertain the facts, not that he or she actually knew or did not know. Finally, proof of mental state. The proof of mental state, the difficulty prosecuting officials would have in proving a mental state in this type of crime, the greater the difficulty, the more likely it is the legislature intended to relieve the prosecution of that burden so that the law could be effectively enforced. Let me ask y'all to think about this. How many of you have tried a speeding case before? As a jurist, you have conducted a trial on a speeding case. Okay? I want you to imagine, how many of you have tried more speeding cases than you ever want to admit to anyone? How many of you have tried? Okay. Can you imagine what it would be like if your prosecutor had to prove culpable mental state on speeding? First of all, I'm not sure if it's possible. Okay. Secondly, if it is possible, it would be devastating. I mean, it would take up so much time. We understand. I think this is a pretty simple factor to apply. Finally, the number of prosecutions, and this is interesting. The number of prosecutions to be expected is another factor of some importance. The fewer the expected prosecutions, the more likely the legislature meant to require the prosecuting official to go into the issue of fault. The greater the number of prosecutions, the more likely the legislature meant to impose liability without regard to fault. So, okay, what? Is this like a wholesale warehouse business now? You know, high volume? Obviously, you can see how this, when you apply these factors to speeding, you can see how it would come down to suggest no fault. You don't have to prove culpable mental state. Let's go back to my septic code violation, however. That might be one that, because of the fact we don't prosecute those things all the time, you have to prove one. Okay? So those are the factors. Now, we're in the runaway scrape here. 6.02c, the requirement of culpability. If the definition does not plainly dispense with a mental element, 3 of 4 will suffice. Criminal negligence, however, will not suffice. Okay, this is interesting. I find that judges and prosecutors often overlook this. What the legislature is saying is, guess what? If we forgot to put one in, or if your city council forgot to put one in, that's all right. We got a spare in the trunk. We'll give you one. Even if they didn't give you one, they gave you one through 6.02c. So even if the statute is silent, and assuming that the state still has to prove some culpable mental state, they can use any culpable mental state they want as long as it's not criminal negligence. That's the reason quite often as a prosecutor, if I'm in this situation, which culpable mental state am I most likely to allege? I'm going reckless. I'm going second to the lowest. Okay, then I'm going to try to prove intentionally or knowingly, and that could, because it's a lesser included. We'll talk about that right now. 6.02d. Culpable mental states are classified to the following degrees, from highest to lowest, all right? And what we know is this, that if your prosecutor is required to prove reckless and they prove intentionally, does that meet the standard of recklessness? Absolutely. If they are required to prove knowingly and they prove intentionally, does that suffice? Absolutely. If they're required to prove recklessness and they prove knowingly, that works as well. Okay, that's good, but watch out for this common baby prosecutor mistake. The inverse is not true, okay? What I'm saying, we understand that proof of a higher degree of culpability than that charged constitutes proof of the culpability charge. That's 6.02e. This is what 602E means. Proof of intentional also is knowing, reckless, or criminal negligence. Proof of knowing would also be proof of recklessness or criminal negligence. Proof of reckless also is going to constitute proof of negligence. Okay? The diagram kind of makes that one pretty evident. Watch out, though, for the opposite, though, because this is where prosecutors get flubbed all the time. They flub this one accidentally. Proof of criminal negligence is not going to prove recklessness, knowing or intentional. And as a criminal defense lawyer, that might be your best argument. Oh, yeah, he did it. He did it. But you know what the proof tells us? He did it with criminal negligence. Uh-oh, state didn't see that one coming. Okay? Oh, yes, he did it, but he did it recklessly. And the state had to prove intentionally or knowingly. Or finally, oh yes, he did it. He did it knowingly, but you had to prove that he did it intentionally. This is also something that city attorneys are terrible at when they're drafting ordinances, because the state legislature has gotten better. They now will sometimes require multiple, either one or two or even three different culpable mental states. I have seen hundreds of city ordinances that will only pick one culpable mental state. And when I see that as a prosecutor, I shirk. I want to see two culpable mental states for every offense. All right. There is a requirement of culpability. You need to know that in Terry Keel, who's a former state representative, who was sheriff in Travis County, ran for the Court of Criminal Appeals, he passed a law in 2005 that says that, guess what? Your cities do not have the ability to waive culpable mental state for certain city ordinance violations. In other words, your state prosecutor, your city attorney, has to prove a culpable mental state even if your ordinance says they don't have to. Okay? This is section 12.23 of the Penal Code. And this is what they said. If it's a city ordinance that carries a fine of more than $500, they have to prove a culpable mental state. Now, they don't tell you in the law which one they have to prove, but they tell you you have to prove one. Let's talk about this. It brings us to the 5 burning questions, and this is how we're going to conclude today. Question number 1, what kind of offenses carry fines under city ordinances that can potentially exceed $500? Help me out. Give me one of them. Hell yes, you got them all. Fire safety, zoning, public health, sanitation offenses. All right? Question number two. Does this mean that all other ordinance violations that carry a fine of less than $500 are strict liability? Absolutely not. Because Aguirre reminds us, we start off with the assumption that nothing is strict liability unless you say it's strict liability. Without an express waiver, we always go back to our fundamental presumption that there is one required. Question number three. Does 6.02F mean that local governments must revise certain penal ordinances? And my answer to this is not necessarily, but it does mean that your prosecutors better know that regardless of what's in your city's ordinance, that the penal code is going to trump it, and that it is going to set the standard of what has to be proven, not what is in your city ordinance. In other words, hopefully your prosecutors have all gone to school and that they're up on the state of the law, because that is a pretty big deal. Now, that brings us to question number four. What if the ordinance relates to fire safety, health, or zoning, but by the letter of the ordinance, the maximum fine is $500? Would the prosecution still have to prove a culpable mental state? This is the hardest of the questions, and this is one where I had to kind of read the law and take an educated guess. I say it depends. Probably yes, but not because of 6.02F, which is the Terry Keel Amendment. Rather, it's going to be because of 6.02B. Do you remember the one I told you that said that if you don't have one, we'll loan you one? That's the reason why we're probably still going to have a culpable mental state. It has nothing to do with the dollar amount, but rather it's going to have to do with the fact that the state law will loan you a mental state if you have lost yours. Okay, it's still going to require you to prove one up. Finally, I want to show you something. This is a case called Rourke versus Hardy versus the city of Austin. This is a smoking ordinance case, and let's read what the city ordinance said. It said, a person who violates the provision of this chapter commits a Class C misdemeanor punishable by a fine not to exceed $2,000. A culpable mental state is not required for violation of this chapter and need not be proved. Is that legal? Absolutely not, because remember, it's a city ordinance that broke that $500 threshold. This is the Fifth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals affirming the trial court judge's decision that the ordinance was invalid because of this exact issue about culpable mental states being required. All right, finally, is it inconvenient to have to use these Aguirre factors to determine whether an ordinance violation or any other state law, Class C misdemeanor, are strict liability? And my answer is yes, it is. But that's the reason why if you've got a prosecutor who has the burden of proof, you can put the burden on them. If you've got someone who's represented by counsel, you can put the burden on both of them at a pretrial hearing to try to resolve these issues. But here's the one thing you need to know. The odds are it would be a lot easier for your city attorneys to address their ordinances than there is any chance that the Texas legislature is going to come back and revisit the 900-plus state law Class C misdemeanors. All right, folks, with that said, you be safe. I'll see you down the road. Thank you very much.